Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
I could. Hello, I'm Claudia Berlin. I'm 29. I feel like I'm on a dating app. I don't really know. I was the person who heckled on Question Time a couple of weeks ago.
We should start by talking about your intervention on BBC Question Time, in which you are commonly described as heckling, which comes with it certain connotations which I don't think were fair to you. What prompted you to speak out about Gaza at that moment?
Well, I'd already kind of, it kind of felt like fate, really, because I'd been in quite a deep mental health dip, partly life-related, but also since October, seeing what was going on, it was really impacting me and the feeling of sort of powerlessness. And it just sort of dropped into my hands. I'm in the local Palestine Solidarity group, and suddenly they were like, Question Time's coming to Gillingham, which is where I am. So because of my disability and the different issues I have, I can't go to London protests. It's too far. So it felt like the perfect opportunity. And I think at that point, I always knew I was going to do something. The intention was going to be that hopefully I'd get a question answered. I don't know how much you know about how they kind of do Question Time and the process of that.
I mean, I'm sure we'd love to hear more about it, yeah.
So basically, when you apply, first of all, they ask you who you voted for, all these different things. And then they do like a social media check on you. Now, I was convinced there's no way they're going to get me through that. I thought that's
social media check. Oh, nope.
And I was like, it's too late. So I was like, I don't care. I'll try anyway. Now, that should have been the first point. I am absolutely convinced that I was actually put through as a plant because they hoped I would do something really bad. Truly, that's what I think. I think that's what I was put through.
Like, we need some drama, okay? We need some drama. Right. Like, okay, let's go down the list. Let me simulate it. Going down the list of, like, okay, Tory. Now this one's going to cause trouble.
Well, they were so unusually accommodating. Because I have, like, anxiety issues, I was like, is it all right if I bring a family member with me? So I was going to bring my mum or my brother. I ended up going with my mum. And so nice. So it was like, oh, of course, why not? You know, that's really lovely. So I'm really confused at that point because I'm thinking, how have I even got through to this point? Now, you submit questions. You have to submit two questions. They've got to be 25 words each. So that's really hard anyway. And I didn't really know what to ask. So I thought the best thing to do was in the Palestine Solidarity Group, we've got a Palestinian academic. And so I kind of went through her, got in touch with her, and she wrote the questions. And I thought, and I kind of knew they're not going to get asked. It turns out that the way it's actually done, you put your questions in. On the actual night, they decide, like literally when you're there, who's going to ask the questions and who isn't. And I think that's so they don't get some sort of like revolution among people there. And it's chosen by three people. Just three people. When I was brought in, I made it really clear. I was like, I'm going to have to, is it all right if I sit on the end because of my anxiety? But rather than seat us, like, with everyone else on the end, the audience producer, like, led us around and sat me directly in front of where I didn't realise Constantine was going to be sitting.
And was that someone on the panel?
Yes. So he.
Oh,
was
yes,
the, like,
I've seen the clip. Yeah. He was the one shouting back at you, yeah.
And he's been running on this as well, because he, even though he was there in the building and knew exactly that the whole thing was about Gaza, like, I think it was really obvious to us there. I don't know how much could be heard. But he's been for a long time on his channel, like, oh, she hated my, I love Britain, and she was heckling. And it's like, you know that's not what was
Oh, he made a video. He made a video about you.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Like, yeah, on his channel, like, all that kind of thing. I've had a lot of hate from that.
Oh.
But yeah, I at the very start of the show, you kind of go, it was in like a local college and you're in like a sort of cafeteria area and everyone's sitting there. And then Fiona Bruce comes in to give like a little speech. And that in itself was really, really weird vibes, because the whole vibe of the show is so unbearable. It's just smug. It is tutting. And even as you go into that room, I mean, I personally found her manner to be so rude to people in that room. It was unreal. Like, you were allowed to ask a few questions, and someone kind of put their hand up and asked about, oh, like, how are our questions selected, etc.? And she kind of answered, and someone was like, it's just that, you know, Nigel Farage has, like, is, like, the fourth, the person who's, like, the fourth most popular on the show. He's been on there so many times. Lawrence Fox. And she got really defensive. I think she said something like, oh, you think you have a problem with that, do you? You think you can do it better? Something like that. And you know what? It was so... It was
Someone's been asked that question a lot of times and doesn't have an answer and feels very defensive about
Definitely.
It.
Definitely. But it was horrible because they'd obviously got an audience full of right-wing... Like, where we live, all I can describe it as is lots of people who are just like Ian Beale. He's from EastEnders.
I'm not familiar.
that hopefully to other people they'll get that. So they were like, you know, laughing along, like, oh, you know, these people questioning saintly Fiona Bruce. Like, I don't get it. She's just a person. And then she kind of was asking, you know, has anyone got any questions or anything else? And someone put their hand up and they were really polite and they said, would it be all right, Fiona, if, you know, if they don't answer our question or they keep or they divert from our question, the person we're asking, or they go on for ages? Would it be all right for you to interject so that we can kind of re-point them to our question? I swear she kind of like, she was like, you don't like the way I do it. Is that what you're saying? you're saying that it could be done better. And it's that kind of attitude of like, and everyone in the room laughing. But that was the point when, first of all, I realized, yeah, this is as bad as I thought. But second of all, so she said in that room, she said at the end, we didn't know if we were going to be asking a question or not yet. By then, she said, there's going to be a question at the end, which is when we've got 5 minutes to go. And it will be a light question, a funny question. It won't be political. It's meant to be like a fun, silly question. So in my mind, I'd already said, right, if they haven't addressed Gaza at all, it doesn't have to be my question, but if they haven't addressed it, that's when I was going to do it. And my poor mum knew I was going to do that. And she's sitting there praying, thinking, I do hope that they ask something because she knew fully my plan. But yeah, that was basically it. I feel like I'm missing out so many things. But, you know, the question at the end as well, it was like, I was going to do it at the end anyway. But the question was about hope for young people.
I know. I watched the clip. I was going to think of including a clip of it in the audio, but it's... They were shutting you down so much that I don't know if it's that like useful for it. But I watched it and I was like, what? You're talking about hope for young people and there's you've just got this right wing YouTuber going on.
It was kind of unbelievable, really, you know, that they'd gone to him first of all. He clearly had a pre rehearsed answer, which was just gonna be, oh, Britain's great and I hate the woke people and cancel culture. Had no relevance, but it almost felt planned because they didn't have much time left. It very much felt like he was a friend of this show. I mean, before we went in, when Fiona Bruce was talking about the people, she didn't talk about any of them with any warmth, apart from Konstantin. And she said, he's so funny, he's sharp as a tack, he's so amusing every time he's on, you know, you'll love it. And I'm sitting there, now I couldn't, in that room, I couldn't make the faces I wanted to, because I'm still undercover at that point. So I'm sort of sitting there really neutrally, and I'm thinking, right, well, that confirms everything, because... this guy is obviously the only one that you guys like. And I just thought I wanted to speak. I couldn't let him end the show with that as well. Like, the idea that as we only just, you know, they'd revealed that we'd started bombing Yemen.
The timing of it, wow.
So literally, it was a day before the ICJ ruling was going to come out. And they were meant to be doing topical things. So, I mean, after the show, you know, some really nice people kind of came up to me and we were all really stunned because, you know, our questions had all been, they were supposed to be things related to things happening that week.
Yeah.
And we were just stunned that none of it even got covered.
It's the day before the ICJ ruling as well.
Yeah.
Like, they talked about it then, like 2 weeks later, I think.
Well,
finally.
Well, it was the week after, and it was in Glasgow, and I know they're so much better in Glasgow. And I don't know if they were under some pressure. I know that it caused a bit of a stink, because I think a lot of people were kind of saying, even people who probably wouldn't like me very much, were at least saying, like, you know, why did she not get the mic? Other people had heckled throughout the show and had been, like, given the mic, and Fiona had gone
really?
To them. Yeah, quite
That's interesting.
People. Yeah, that was...
I didn't
was,
know that.
Yeah, multiple times. So when it was about the Tories, you know, that's the safe thing. You know, they're all laughing about it. And they're calling out and heckling, and then they get the mic to make their point. And that's all lovely. And then with me, it's like, oh, we can't hear you. You don't have a mic. It's like, you literally just lower the mic over somebody.
Yeah, I thought that was very odd. I was like, this is, yeah, usually hecklers, the mic descends from the heavens. Because yeah, it's part of the show, right? It's part of the pageantry. But no, they were like, no.
No, it was kind of desperation. I was nervous about doing it. Like, it's the most disruptive thing I've ever done. And also, it was live, so...
I did mean to say at the start, like, it was very brave, because that's surrounded by a lot of people, all of whom did not want you to do that, and a panel of people, including a very stern Fiona Bruce, who were very disapproving. I, despite my own reputation, I am by nature also not a confrontational person. So I know it could be really rough. So it was very admirable. It was very brave.
Thank you.
I really respect it.
Thank you. But then I don't really think it wasn't really that brave. Like, I was nervous about doing it, but I just, someone should. And in some way, you know, I've already had a bit of rubbish from different people and I've had my channel, so I can do public speaking. I kind of thought, well, I can be a bit of a shield. It doesn't, you know, what does it really matter to me? But yeah, no, it was really intimidating. And, it's all a bit of a blur, and I still haven't really watched it back. I know I was upset in some of it, like, I look upset, and that's genuine. Like, I couldn't actually understand that I was looking these people in the eyes, and I was kind of saying, I think I said something like, thousands of innocent children are dying. Like, what if, I think I kept saying, what if it was your children? Like, we are armed, or something like that. And to look people in the eyes, and to have them scoff and look away as if you're just some hooligan was really stunning. You know, it was genuinely, you don't expect the inhumanity of that. And then you've got jeers in the audience as well, people being like, oh, shut up, you know, all that kind of thing, which I kind of drowned out. But my poor mum has been more upset by all this than me.
Oh, of course. Yeah,
she's I keep telling her, like, not, don't look at stuff, because I've got all these weirdo far-right people who are like, deport her and all that kind of thing. And I keep saying to mum, like, don't engage. But she's like, it's really hard because you're my daughter, kind of thing.
I remember one time when I realized that part of me is smiling. I'm smiling at the ridiculousness of the situation. Yeah. Obviously, yeah. The topic and what you went through, very serious. But I mentioned to my parents about some of the things I get directed at me online, and they were like, what? I was like, yeah, it's just normal. But it shouldn't be normal. It is to normal people, to normies, it's quite shocking when they see that kind of thing. So I very much understand why your mum would feel that way. It's very disconcerting to see people spewing that kind of venomous hatred.
It really
for something
is
very, very benign, and very, very reasonable.
Yeah, and I honestly think the reason they didn't take me out immediately, well, I think there's a number of reasons. Security was immediately there, panicking. Oh, you couldn't see them off screen. And they were kind of grouped together, like, what are we going to do? We're going to remove her. What are we going to do? They did threaten to remove me at one point. yeah. So it was it was intimidating. It was quite intimidating.
Yeah.
But then I also knew, you know, I can't complain because I knew kind of what I was getting into, but it was quite intimidating. And I think they were kind of a bit stuck because I truly think I was meant to, they wanted me to go there, and I don't know what they wanted me to say. And they don't know if I was going to suddenly be like evil or say something anti-Semitic or something, or,
oh,
you know,
Christ.
And I think it kind of ruined it that I was just sort of pleading, I guess. I was just like pleading, and then I didn't know how to handle that. But yeah, no, it was a really horrible, it was a really surreal thing afterwards, you know, when people were kind of leaving. There was quite a few, like, nasty comments and things, like, as people went by and stuff like that. Fiona Bruce came up and gave me a talking to as well.
Jesus. Oh, how terrifying, Fiona right, Bruce.
That's the thing. And this is, like, it's kind of got me into trouble in my life, but it's also a bit of a superpower. Like, I am not overawed by authority figures, ever.
Yes.
I'm just not. Like, I respect all people, but I don't think because you're famous that, like, it's not... I didn't sit there like everyone else where she could have said anything to them and they would have been like, oh, Fiona Bruce, you know. She's just a person. And she sort of came up and she said to these kind of security officers, she was like, I'll handle this.
So good!
She was like,
silly.
I'll come and speak to you or something. Maybe I might be misremembering. She certainly came. My mind's a bit jumbled. But
listen,
she
it doesn't matter. Nobody else is going to come and talk about the story. And it sounds true. That's good enough for me. Don't clip that. Nobody clip that. It sounds true, so it's good enough for me. Let me edit that out. More evidence that Sats for Lefties loves spreading propaganda and misinformation. Anyway.
But she kind of came up and she was kind of giving me that, you know, that reasonable talking to, like, very stern. She was kind of like, I did explain at the beginning that you wouldn't be able to, you know, we might not get to everyone's questions, but you mustn't shout out or something like that. And I looked her dead in the eyes and I just said, I just said something like 12,000, something like, I can't remember how many people it was at that point. It's awful because it's gone up so much. And I said the number of people that were dead to her, and I was really calm. I wasn't, you know, and I just said, how come it wasn't even addressed? I was like, you didn't even talk about it and people are dying. I looked her in the face and I said, like, you must have people you love. I said, what if it was your children that were under the rubble? Like, how would you feel about that? And, you know, she just did that kind of, like, sort of brushing off sort of, well, you might feel passionately about it, but we have to go with what the room wants. And the room didn't want to hear about that. I've since realised from other people there that lots of people had submitted questions about Gaza, so I think it was deliberately sidestepped. And I actually, and this is genuine, I actually, she was kind of saying this, and I stared her in the face, and I really shouldn't have said this, this is rude. I looked her in the face, and I said, where's your spine, Fiona Bruce?
You're very cool. I realise we've just met, but that's very cool, yeah.
It just came out, but not angrily. I think that was disarming for them because I wasn't angry. I was vulnerably saying it.
Yeah.
And then she just kind of was ushered off. I think she was a bit angry about that. it was all just a bit of a blur. But, like, I know I'm kind of, like, laughing, like, talking about it right now. But the upset of it was I couldn't understand how. I don't mind that they were angry at me. But they were all hearing what I was saying, which was about the number of dead people and dead children. And it wasn't even handled with a sort of compassion that was, we understand and rest assured, like, in a future show we'll get through this, or... It wasn't like that. It was treated so differently and with such hostility.
It's like, this doesn't matter. You might as well be talking about dead characters in a video game.
Well, they were all
performing. It seems about as real to them as that, yeah.
I think because they were all performing, and I genuinely do think every single person on that panel was... It was bizarre to see them switch on. It was like we knew what they were going to say, what their positions were. They weren't really... Although we were allowed to ask questions, they weren't really talking to us. We weren't really able to respond to them. It was like they were all playing their parts, and they were all kind of friends and all in on it. Like, you know, I'm playing the right wing and I'm playing the Labour one, and I'm sort of... It was like they were all friends. It was like they were... None of them were real. And that, I couldn't...
It's the old saying that it's all a big club and you're not in it. But all these people, they're in it. It's why you don't tend to see, like, Owen Jones or Jeremy Corbyn or even Caroline Lucas on Question Time all that much, because they're not in this club. They're big, they're prominent figures, but they're not in this club. And so they don't really get on well with them in the back rooms where they're waiting to get ready. I think Owen has talked about that before, that, like, people are trying to be chummy with him and he just isn't. And they don't know how to respond because he's just like, no, I'm here to talk about real issues. What are you here for?
Well, that's what I just can't understand. You know, I think some of them were treating it like I was... Because that was what they were there for. They were projecting it as well. And to try and get someone to look at you, like, and it's like desperation, really, like a sort of sincerity, saying, like, no, please just listen to what I'm saying. Please answer. And it's like, oh, it's all part of the game. We've got a fun heckler, and we're on this funny question time. And just the whole thing was just, I mean, I was really, I don't want to say traumatized. That's completely the wrong word because I'm not in Gaza.
You were affected by it. You're affected by it. It's totally natural to be affected by it.
Yeah, the things I'd seen, you know, I really had them with me. And I made sure that I did, like, I was reading some of South Africa's case that morning, you know, to give myself strength for it. And I was sort of because I am not someone who shouts. I've had loads of people saying, you know, oh, she's like badly brought up and things like that, and attacking the most wonderful teacher of mine as well, who backed me up. But as anyone who knows me will know, I was like the opposite. I was too good at school. I was like nervous about, like, I was really good. Yeah, but I don't know. I guess it feels weird. Even like, it's nice to be like asked to talk about it, kind of thing. But it's not really about me, but the experience that to be in that room of people and to be talking about literally people that are being killed, and to get that response, like a dead-eyed response, and even a response of hatred from people, is so incredibly jarring to me. I mean, I couldn't imagine it. I was thinking about if someone had spoken about, like, say they were talking about the Israeli hostages, and they were talking about the pain of that, I couldn't stare at them in a dead-eyed manner. I think I'd still have to say to them, you know, I really hope they're okay. I really hope they're going to be okay. And, yeah, you know,
because they're people. It's impossible not to like, acknowledge
the human emotion of
there.
That. The human emotion of pain. You know, I couldn't imagine it. You know, like, I couldn't imagine, you know, Constantine, I've since found out, is an awful, you know, far right, whatever he is. But if he was earnestly, like, upset and, like, please help a certain group of people, you know, I couldn't be like, scoffing.
What do you think that those of us in the West, living in the West, can do to support Palestinians? Because you yourself said, like, that you have difficulty in getting to London protest. I'm exactly the same. Mm. I've not been able to get to one. I've gone to some in my city, but not as many as I'd like. So what do you think we can do? Obviously, I wouldn't, you know, I'm not treating you as an expert on this, but it's good to hear your ideas.
Well, I mean, yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, I'm really not an expert, but in terms of, I just think whatever we can personally do, I mean, marching, if we can march, where that works. I think that making sure it's on social media, and I don't mean that people shouldn't find joy in their lives and that people shouldn't have happiness, but it mustn't go out of the news cycle because it's happening all the time. You know, I see so many people in fandom or influencers and things, good people, and their reach would mean everything. Just make sure that people realise, because our media is not doing its job. And I think that's really important. I mean, I've found it very difficult. I haven't really been able to make other videos on my channel because it just hasn't felt appropriate, really. Obviously, boycotting, really important, and spreading awareness about the boycott. I would recommend people get involved with solidarity groups, because I think if you're not part of groups like that, you get totally lost in the despair and the grief of it, and then in some ways you're useless. Because I've been really upset about this stuff, and you know, I'm quite openly emotional about it, but, and that is important, but also, like, it needs to be filtered in a way that, if possible, can help. I think definitely talking to the people around us. I mean, I do it a lot on social media, but difficult conversations with people in your lives, like family and things like that, are quite hard, but have to be done. I think the most difficult thing I find is it's not that people aren't good and they care, it's that they truly believe, and I can't blame them for this because I was the same a few years ago, they truly believe that the BBC is giving them unbiased news. They trust in it, and they're good people. And
it's so baffling. I look at the, like, the data on this, and it's like, you'll see immense distrust of the tabloid media, immense distrust of GB News, and then you look at even Labour voters, even people who voted for Corbyn, and it's like, oh yeah, the BBC? Yeah. Trust them. They tell me the truth. They tell me everything that's going on. And I just look at, like, are we watching the same, like, stuff? Like, are we watching the same BBC?
I just think that is the most difficult thing, because, you know, you end up becoming that sort of person in the family that's the crazy crank one, you know, and you're, they
sound like a conspiracy theorist. It's like, I'm not, I say as I make my hair look all crazy.
No, but it really is just, you know, I try and say, you know, well, just try and vary your news outlets. So I'll say, you know, watch a bit of Al Jazeera. I'm not saying Al Jazeera English is perfect, but I'm saying at least look at different things. You know, maybe look at social media. You know, I've tried to get some people to watch Owen Jones videos, you know, just, but people do think you're a crank and a conspiracist, and it's so difficult with, like, older relatives, and it's so frustrating because the BBC has just got them so, so manipulated. You know, they've got them, I believe, on the ITV News the other night. They were focused on a story that, because of the Red Sea blockade, we might get less tea bags here.
So you have been very critical of Keir Starmer and his approach to the Labour Party, including on Palestine. Would you be able to expand on this for us?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think he's a liar. I know that when I wasn't as well educated or involved when Corbyn was kind of taken down, I was still very naive. I was very early on. I was one of those people who I really was naive. Like, I was thinking, you know, surely, you know, it can't be anything shady or anything like that. You know, I'm sure it'll all get worked out. And I remember vividly that Keir Starmer was running as the unity candidate. I didn't vote for him. I personally went for Rebecca Long-Bailey at the time. But I didn't have an issue. And I remember thinking when he got in, it wasn't like a bad feeling towards him. I thought, well, he keeps talking about a broad church, unity. He wants to keep a lot of, you know, what Jeremy Corbyn's done. And I understood and I thought, okay, he's not as left as Corbyn, but that's his right. But he positioned himself as being that unity candidate. And I kind of thought, oh, okay, that's good. And it was just a lie to get elected. If he hadn't said that, he would not be Labour leader right now. It's that lie, that very, very early lie that people just don't talk about. That was how he got in. And he didn't just, you know, he got in and he purged out the left. It's not a case of a leader leading it with his own values, but allowing people to think their own. He's fundamentally changed the party forever. And he's openly said this himself. He has purged out elements he doesn't like. And it's just devastating because now, obviously, the Overton window has shifted so far. People think he's left. That still makes me laugh that people think that, but they think that he's the left candidate. He's really not, because they've made Jeremy Corbyn, who was never an extremist, into some radical extreme crank. So if he's the reasonable left, everything shifts, and obviously we're going to go really far right. And I think he's always known that. I've never trusted the fact that he was director of public prosecutions. Because in my mind, I'm thinking, being a human rights lawyer is a wonderful thing to do. But generally, I think if you're really in it for the right reasons, you'd probably go more towards, okay, well, these are the elements of the law that actually aren't serving the vulnerable groups. We need to help it. But no, I think someone who gets to that point is somebody the establishment know is going to go along with things. I think, you know, he's so devoid of principle, just ambition.
I mean, he's a cop. Like, he was the top cop. I've never understood why people thought that electing a prosecutor as the leader of a Social Democratic Party was ever a good idea. Mm-hmm. He's a man who, I mean, people know my personal opinions on him. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in yours, but yeah, I agree.
It sounds like we align. I mean, I just couldn't. It's his cruelty and his callousness. And I noticed this with the marginalised groups. He truly uses every marginalised group and then throws them away. It's absolutely, I can't quite believe it. I mean, recently, I couldn't quite believe. He's been using the trans community as a scapegoat. He's been dog whistling for so long. And then he gets a photo opportunity with Brianna Jai's mother. And you know that he will go back on anything he's promised her.
You know, I mean, he hasn't even promised her anything related to trans rights whatsoever. He's been talking about, and again, it's no shade on Brianna's mother. Like,
no, of course
she's
not.
Pursuing whatever campaign she thinks is best. But Starmer has not promised her anything related to trans rights. He'll probably go back on whatever he's promised her as well. I don't think he has any commitment to anything beyond his own power. And you get all these Labour members saying, oh, well, winning power is what matters, you know? Winning power is what matters. It's like, yeah, but he's going to be in office for 5 years. What's he going to do? Do you just not care? I don't think they care.
No, I mean, I think it is a game to them. I think all the real people they've got rid of. I think one of the cases which, I mean, so one of my friends who I think you would love to talk to, she's amazing. She's called Heather Mendick. We do a podcast together. She's a grassroots activist. She's a wonderful Jewish woman. And she actually found herself being investigated for anti-Semitism, which was very difficult for her. And then eventually they kind of kicked her out. And she is just the most wonderful, kind, just standing up for every sort of justice you can imagine. You know, just genuinely brave and wonderful person. And I remember kind of going onto her content, and she'd been kind of smeared as a crank. And I saw how the processes of the party had been used by Starmer in his authoritarian way to get rid of people he didn't like. And it was him talking about, you know, one day he'd be talking about misogyny in the party or domestic abuse, while leaving Apsana Begum to suffer for all that time. You know, not helping Zara Sultana when she was getting all that abuse, letting Diane Abbott take the fall. And it was so, to me, it was really obvious. Like, once I'd seen it, I couldn't unsee it. And I suppose I need to be more tolerant with people who haven't got there yet, because that was me a couple of years ago. But to me, it's just so obvious that all he's going to do is get into power. Nothing really is going to change. If anything, it's just going to be more efficient. And then it's going to swing back to the right. Worse.
I am very concerned about that exact thing, that he will do indeed what many Democrats have done in the United States, which is take power and then shuffle away a few of the more embarrassingly public Tory mistakes, like the Rwanda deal, which is so disgustingly racist and vile that, like, it's if you're someone who, like Starmer, believes in strong immigration controls, it's an embarrassing thing to have on the books, because it just makes it so explicit how monumentally vicious the immigration system is. So he will clear that away, I have no doubt. But then they'll just make the existing immigration system so much more efficient. Like, they constantly talk about how they're going to deport so many people. Like, when they talk about, like, you know, getting in more enforcement officers to process more people, it's like, no, that's code for deport all of them.
Yeah.
As quickly as possible. And we know this because Labour has deported far more people than the Conservative Party has, and had a massively higher deportation rate than the Conservatives did.
No, he refers to, I've noticed that the language he uses is so dehumanising. He talks about the asylum backlog. There's no humanity in that. These are people, you know, the thing about Jeremy Corbyn, I you know, he genuinely believed and he had principles and he felt these things. You know, Starmer is just thinking, this isn't efficient and I need to prove myself to the right. And he's just, no matter what his motivation is, that is a man who can put aside the fact that these are real human beings for his political strategy. And I think it's naive of people to think, you know, obviously, if you're already in a marginalised group, you might understand that. But if he can do that to them, he can do that to anyone. It means that people aren't human beings. It's his path to what he wants, and a bit of collateral doesn't matter. That should worry everyone, and I'm really concerned as, you know, why aren't people seeing that? And why aren't people afraid of somebody who's more efficient and has something to prove?
I think for a lot of people, him being in opposition is like a tabula rasa. He's whatever they want him to be. They project what they want onto him, which will be significantly harder when he's in government. And that's why, you know, it's the ideal situation is him ending up in power but falling short of a majority. Then people get to see how he actually uses power, but he doesn't have an unlimited blank check. You have spent a lot of time discussing fandoms as a content creator, whether it's Doctor Who or other ones. And one of the things, and we were just talking about this, how do you think that fandom interacts with politics? Because to a lot of people, it feels as if Keir Starmer's supporters are, some would say, a cult.
Yeah.
I wouldn't use that word personally. I think that, like, there are things that are cults and we should reserve that word for them. But fandom, to me, has increasingly felt like the right word. So I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's very much become football teams. Like, it's so disturbing. It's the colour that people are voting for, but it doesn't seem to matter to them what that person or that party want to do politically. Because if you point out to them the similarities in policy, I mean, you've seen this a lot in America. You know, with Biden, where when it was Trump, the thing that bothered the Democrats, Biden does the same things, and they're suddenly like, oh, that's all right. And it's exactly the same. And it's like the colours change. That's all that's happened here. They just see it as a game and they do project their fantasies onto him very oddly. And I think I wouldn't call it a cult either, but I think the reason I might say that to wind people up is because I know that it was called like the cult of Corbyn.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, when we're talking seriously about it, I'm entirely on board for saying anything that upsets Starmer supporters. I think it's really funny. Is it? I mean, again, I don't mind saying this publicly. A lot of the things that I post, like, they are designed to wind people up, and it's really funny when they fall for the bait. Oh, it's good. Before we go, would you like to, is there anything you'd like to plug?
Nothing with me, really. I suppose you'll probably have these on your own channel, but Medical Aid for Palestinians, the Oxfam Gaza Appeal, if you can get in touch with your local Palestine Solidarity campaign group, anything like that, I would recommend. In terms of me, I do make some music and I do some YouTube, but that's on a break at the moment because of the situation of, you know, what's going on. And hopefully things will get better and, you know, I'll kind of return to that. But right now I want to use my channel for those things. So, yeah.
No, that's very noble. But anyway, it's been lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And especially thank you for being up for doing the video side of it. I hope you have a lovely day, and I'm sure I will talk to you again.
Definitely.
Just wanted to finish this by saying thank you to my beloved Patreon subscribers who make my work possible. Mick Mikatir, Joe Bird, Ben, Mohammed Mumit, Duncan Black, Joseph Bailey, Barry James, Neil Barton, Yuditha De Silva, Thomas Alexander, Ruth Holliday, Conrad, Chris Gravel, Patrick Lefebvre, Bert Rothkugel, Stephen Carr, Alex Wilson, and Scott Folan. It is thanks to these people that my work is possible, and if you want, like them, to enjoy the hour-long episodes of Stats for Lefties podcast and other content, be sure to visit patreon.com/leftystats to subscribe from £2 to £5 a month. Thanks again, guys. Love you all very much.